This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A big company marches onto your land, sinks a well without your permission, then proceeds to threaten your livelihood.
The drilling sites are springing up like topsy all over their farms, some with significant gas leakage. And Australia's greatest underground water resource, the Great Artesian Basin, will be contaminated and depleted.
And it's our laws and our politicians who are letting it happen.
Big business lusts for dough. The government conducts the flow, prostituting our mother.
You just heard Act Locally, Think Globally by McShay Jasmine and the Awesomes. It's from a whole album of 14 anti-fracking songs called Whole Lot of Fracking Going On. It's a great new album, available from www.wholelotoffrackinggoingon.com with the help of our feature background artist this week, Australia's own Ariel Kalma. And thanks to singer-organizer Laura Doe for sending this along. That's right. We humans aren't satisfied polluting the atmosphere with toxic guck, radioactive particles, and greenhouse gases. Nope. Not finished with spreading all our poisons over the surface of every continent either. We just can't rest until we manage to take the most toxic chemical crap we've got and injecting it at least a mile underground. All to get more carbon-trapping gases to burn out the climate. It's the last frontier, the deep underground, and we'll poison the last fresh water and blow out the coal seams if we can. The frackers are hitting Australia right now. Their drilling rigs will set up, blow up the deep, and then move on endlessly till there's nothing left. Get ready in Britain for more of the same. Now that the North Sea gas field production is 25% down, they'll tell you it's green, much cleaner than coal. Green all the way down to a wrecked planet with more fossil fuels. Just wait for the Marcellus gas fracking field in New York State to leak into the watershed for millions of people. Oops. The roving drill companies will fold into their corporate shells and evaporate, leaving the groundwater poisoned for centuries. Before we get to the unreported panic in the Arctic, and before we count up the late record rate of extinctions with author Peter Sale, and even before we interview the filmmaker who tracked down big oil crime, all coming up on Radio EcoShock.
Oh my God! Breaking up!
Rushed expedition finds methane torches in the Arctic. The research ship RV Polarstern has returned to Bremerhaven, Germany, with its crew of scientists from six countries. They traveled almost 12,000 nautical miles on the 26th Arctic expedition, measuring ice in the polar seas. The verdict? Arctic sea ice is young and very thin. For centuries, polar seas have been covered by a thick layer of ice built up over many years. America designed a nuclear submarine capable of breaching up through and breaking that tough Arctic ice. Now it's weak, with much less mass, the first step towards losing the Arctic ice cap due to global warming. Greenpeace icebreaker Arctic Sunrise is just now returning to Amsterdam after a two-month expedition with scientists from Cambridge studying ice thickness. The news is alarming, as the Earth's new dark seascape in the summer Arctic will pump more heat into the oceans and add to long-term climate change. Scientist Wieslaw Maslowski's team predict the Arctic ice cap could disappear in summer as early as 2016. There is worse, and you won't hear this in the mainstream media at all. Behind the scenes, officials and scientists in various countries and governments went into panic mode this September. The problem? A big increase in methane gas was reported by ships traveling the northern route, and methane gas has been discovered in the eastern Arctic. If frozen methane gas under the sea, technically called clathrates, melt in quantity, we are on the road to a dramatic climate shift beyond imagination. It happened before, around 56 million years ago. In less than 100 years, the temperature of the Arctic seas rose several degrees, reaching almost 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 30 degrees centigrade. Here is what we know. On September 2nd, the Russian news agency RIA Novosti announced, quote, "A group of Russian and U.S. scientists will leave the port of Vladivostok on Friday on board a Russian research ship to study methane emissions in the eastern part of the Arctic. This expedition was organized on a short notice by the Russian Fund of Fundamental Research and the U.S. National Science Foundation following the discovery of a dramatic increase in the leakage of methane gas from the seabed in the eastern part of the Arctic," said Professor Igor Samilitov, the head of the expedition. The group consists of 27 scientists who would attempt to measure the scale of methane emissions and clarify the nature of the process. The 45-day expedition will focus on the sea shelf of the Laptev Sea, the East Siberian Sea, and the Russian part of the Chukotsk Sea, where 90% of the underwater permafrost is located. We assume that the leakage of methane results from the degradation of underwater permafrost. A massive release of such powerful greenhouse gas may accelerate global warming, Samilitov said. End quote from the Russian press September 2nd. Methane is generally said to be 20 times more powerful than CO2 when it comes to trapping solar heat. That is really just an average because when it first emerges, methane can be as much as 75 times more powerful. It degrades more quickly than CO2, becoming less potent in about 10 years. But methane degrades into CO2, continuing the greenhouse gases for up to 100,000 years, according to Dr. David Archer. So what did this hurry-up research find? We go with the report September 29th from the Russian news agency ITAR TASS. Heavy methane emissions found in the Arctic eastern sector. In the northern sector of the Laptev and Bering Seas, the chief of the expedition, Igor Samilitov, reported by phone that, quote, methane torches, his words, are coming from the ocean seabed into the atmosphere. Also on board were scientists from Alaska Fairbanks Scientific Research Center and Georgia University. I can only conclude that as the Arctic Sea melts back every summer and seas warm, methane from either deep in the ground or from clathrates on the shallower seabeds are starting to melt. The Russians and scientists from the National Oceanography Center in the UK have found methane is leaking up also from fissures deep inside the earth, so we have both frozen methane on the shallow seabeds and geological methane coming up. That the Russians and Americans sent a ship to the Arctic on such short notice tells you how serious this is. Keep in mind, there is no overall way to monitor methane emissions from the whole Arctic, although scientists do monitor global average methane content in the atmosphere. According to my limited research, the amounts coming out of the Arctic so far are smaller than emissions from rice paddies. We haven't seen anything like a giant increase in methane globally yet. But we are seeing the start of a methane source that could, if it grows, easily tip the planet into a new greenhouse world. Keep your eye on the Arctic methane news.
It's a sense of loss. You know, I mean, your future is very uncertain. You know that you're up against one of the most powerful industries in the world, and the industry and the state and federal governments, they're just looking for the money. Mm. And unfortunately, the human cost is not their agenda.
Sooner or later, we see the black dragon behind our oil addiction. These are the mega corporations who span the world. They have private armies of security men and the biggest military in the world behind them. They own politicians, private jets, and maybe a few countries. But the most powerful weapon in the arsenal of big oil is the river of money available for public relations. Advertising sues us, movie placements make us want more. The oil industry is the subtle pusher who keeps us addicted, keeps us coming back to the pumps, keeps us buying plastic products and oil-based foods. If only someone could tell it like it is. That would be Craig Rosebrough. Don't be fooled by the technical-sounding name of his upcoming film. Greedy Lying Bastards is no puff piece for the industry. Craig, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Oh, I appreciate you having me.
Tell us about your new film, just briefly. What should we expect?
Well, this is an inside look at the oil industry, its power and corruption, and really the deceit that it's used to maintain its power and keep all of us addicted to its products. And so, you know, we spent a good amount of time, just about 3 years, traveling around the world and documenting this industry, the impact it's had on nations around the world in terms of not only environmental contamination, but also strong issues like climate change. We documented the impact the industry has on our political process here in the United States in terms of the amount of money it gives to lobbying and PR campaigns, really to confuse us and keep us all once again addicted to their products and ensure that we do not have a clean energy policy in this country.
Well, when it comes to the greedy part, I think about drilling in the Arctic. The fossil fuel companies trigger a massive melting, which should scare the pants off us. And instead of recognizing the danger, they set up big platforms in newly ice-free areas to get more oil to make more climate change. What are some of the things that you cover about climate change in the movie?
One of the things I wanted to look at in the film and in the investigation was why we have this apparent disparity between the scientific body around the world, which is in a what could be considered a consensus opinion based on scientific documentation that human-caused climate change is real and that we need to do something about it. So that's on one hand, and yet on another hand, we have public opinion in the United States very, very low in terms of a belief in climate change, and therefore, you know, no pressure on our political realm to pass any legislation that reduces greenhouse gas emissions. So I wanted to try and figure out why we have that disparity. Science is telling us one thing, and public opinion is completely another. I wanted to figure out why that is. And sure enough, there is a reason for it. And one of the things that we look at is the amount of money that certain companies within this industry spend annually to ensure that there are very, very strong and powerful PR campaigns that confuse us about the issue. They have spent millions of dollars in the last decade alone to fund think tanks, to fund front groups with friendly sounding names who have sometimes scientists, and a lot of times they're not scientists, that come out publicly on, you know, news media organizations like Fox News, and their whole focus is to cast doubt on whether or not climate change exists. And that really has had a instrumental effect at decreasing public support for climate change legislation in this country.
And you do give a little screen time to some of the worst climate deniers.
We do indeed. I felt it was important, you know, not just to talk about the dire impact of this PR campaign waged by the industry, but to actually show it for what it is. So we let the most prominent, what we call climate change deniers in the world, speak on film, and we kind of let them, in a sense, bury themselves by their erratic scientific theories and sometimes just by their sheer rhetoric. And I think that's the most honest way to do it. You know, if we have a scientific fact that can be proven, that's agreed upon by the leading academies around the world, scientific academies around the world, you know, that's something that we should act upon. We shouldn't be, you know, waiting for tomorrow to decide whether or not we're going to protect, you know, our country and the planet.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Craig Roseborough, the writer and director of a new film about big oil called Greedy Lying Bastards. In your new film, Craig, you spent some serious time in the Gulf of Mexico area both before and after the April 2010 deepwater disaster, that BP rig. BP spent a lot of advertising money saying they would make things right for the residents. Did that happen?
From our investigation, overall, no. What BP appeared to do was, again, very, very similar to what we were just talking about. They waged a very, very fierce PR campaign to make it look like, you know, they were using their best efforts to clean up the Gulf and to help the residents in need. And what we found was, you know, largely the opposite. On our first trip down there in 2010, we talked with, you know, one of the fathers whose son died aboard the Deepwater Horizon, and then talked with some of the out-of-work fishermen and business owners down there. And, you know, at that time, everybody initially who put in a claim that was anywhere near legitimate got a $5,000 payoff from BP, and that was called an interim claim. And the problem came with the intermediate claims that came, the follow-up claims, as the months went by and as the oil continued to gush out and the contamination continued to be with the area down there. And to date, of the $20 million or billion-dollar claims fund that BP set up, that Kenneth Feinberg is administering, there's estimates that only 16% of that total fund has been paid out to the applicants, you know, the Gulf residents who've been impacted. And there's a lot of people down there, a lot of people, who still have yet to get any significant reimbursement for their losses. And, of course, when we went down there the second year in 2011 to see kind of what the aftermath was a year later, the health impacts are what were the most startling, where people were suffering just very, very dire health problems from the a combination of the crude, the contamination from the crude that was washing ashore, as well as the dispersant, the Corexit that was applied, and the aerosol that was coming in, you know, through the air and harming the residents down there. So it was a very big mess indeed. And getting back to your question, no, I don't believe that they came anywhere close to making the Gulf whole again.
And I've heard that some of the victims of toxic chemicals are having trouble finding a doctor to treat them.
That's exactly correct. That was another startling fact when we went down there, is that a lot of times when victims or the ill residents were going in and seeking medical attention, they were being denied medical attention in terms of being treated for chemical toxicity because of how integrated and how strong the industry is in the culture down in the South. A lot of the doctors either have direct clients or a part of the industry down in the Gulf down there, and not a lot of people honestly wanted to come up against BP in the industry, you know, if it came down to any kind of court battle where they had to prove, you know, that this particular client or this particular patient, for instance, was suffering X health problem because of Corexit, for instance. So there were a few. Dr. Mike Robichaud in Louisiana is considered a local hero by many people down there, and he's been one that's kind of paid for a lot of out of his own pocket the treatments for a lot of the sick residents down there.
And I even heard about one case in Florida where some people were just swimming on a beach. They weren't close to the tankers. They weren't close to Corexit, they thought, but they still had serious health problems come out of it.
That's correct. That was one of the severe cases that we investigated. Stephen Aguinaga and his friend Merrick Valian went with their wives. They were lifelong friends. They went down to the Gulf Coast in Florida on a little vacation, and they were told by the local hotel there and the local authorities that it was safe to go in the water because the oil didn't wash up in that area. And the beaches, of course, they said, looked completely clean, so they didn't think there was any problem with it. They went in the water and went swimming. You know, they were in there for about an hour and a half. And when Stephen came out, his wife noticed there was this orange goo all over him that was just stuck to him. And they didn't really think, put two and two together and think it was, you know, oil or anything like that. But all four of them started experiencing kind of flu-like symptoms that evening and didn't, again, put two and two together. They just thought maybe they all came down with something or something they ate. So the next day, Stephen's friend Merrick, he went back in the water again and swam for another couple hours. And he came out and felt even sicker than he did earlier the night before. So within 3 weeks, Stephen was suffering extreme health problems due to the toxic exposure that he was faced with from swimming in there. And his friend Merrick Valian actually died. From what we can tell and looking at his medical records, he was in very good health. He was a young guy in his, I believe, early 30s at the time. And for all intents and purposes, it appears, though, the toxic exposure that he was faced with swimming repeatedly in basically pools of crude led to his death.
Craig Roseborough, tell us about your testing of Gulf food sea safety, the seafood safety there.
Yes, we had talked with a couple chemists down there who have been testing the soil, the water, and the seafood for safety in terms of the level of petroleum hydrocarbons, and really comparing that with what the federal government had been saying is safe. And so they had told us when we were down there that their findings were completely different than what the federal government were coming up with, and their findings in terms of the toxicity of seafood were not safe for human consumption. So I thought it would be interesting for us to take our own test. And I went down on Grand Isle and collected a sample of sand. We collected water. And I also bought some fresh-caught Gulf shrimp that were right off the boat there in Grand Isle. And we took them into an independent lab for testing. And the results came back a few weeks later. I was just amazed. The results were 4,900 parts per million of petroleum hydrocarbons, which is 10 times higher than the safe limit set by the FDA after the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill. So our shrimp were 10 times more toxic than the safe consumption level. And these are shrimp that when I was standing in line to buy them, other families and purveyors and, you know, local retailers were buying the same shrimp and were selling them and eating them that day. so it was really startling to see that direct evidence of how toxic that food supply is, and then just to think about, oh my gosh, is that seafood all oversaturated in the U.S. food supply right now? And unfortunately, for all intents and purposes, it is.
And then they had the scientific test, which was just to smell it and see if it was okay.
Yeah. That is something that's hard for me to believe, is that the majority of the testing that was done and promoted by the federal government in terms of the safety limit for consumption of fish came down to a smell test. That was just beyond me. I just couldn't realize that that was actually true and not just some sort of joke, you know, a really, really dark joke. And then, of course, when we did take that test ourselves and the results came back at 10 times higher, the safe limit set by the FDA of petroleum hydrocarbons, it just confirmed that their test obviously isn't working.
Is this film, Greedy Lying Bastards, just about the United States?
It is not. This industry is not just a national industry within the United States. It's an industry that is worldwide, and its existence relies upon its ability to continue to explore worldwide. And so we actually filmed in a total of 14 countries, but I think in the final cut of the film, the footage comes from about 9 countries around the world. And what we looked at, not only was the industry and its contamination, but we talked with scientists, politicians, as well as individuals and communities that are impacted by the industry all around the world, from Uganda and also Kenya down to Peru. We were over in Tuvalu, as well as up in Kivalina, which is a small Inupiaq Native American community off the northwestern coast of Alaska above the Arctic Circle. And a lot of the locations, we wanted to look at the direct evidence today of climate change and what it is actually doing to individual communities, a lot of times subsistence communities, and the impacts that are faced as a result of the reckless and unchecked release of these greenhouse gas emissions into our atmosphere. And the results were startling, honestly, just to see the impacts to these small communities.
If you've just tuned in, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. My guest is Craig Roseborough, and we're talking about his upcoming film, Greedy Lying Bastards. So, Craig, who are some of the people that you got on camera for this movie, and maybe tell us a couple that you tried and couldn't get?
Sure. We have a lot of people on camera for the film, and the hard part, of course, is we have so much information trying to actually whittle it down and figure out, you know, in our final cut, what's going to be the most impactful and tell our story the best. But some of the most prominent, you know, individuals we have in the film include Representative Henry Waxman from California, of course, who's been a strong proponent of clean energy policies in the country. Of course, he was one of the sponsors of the Waxman-Markey bill, co-writer of it. We have Christine Todd Whitman, who is a former EPA administrator under the Bush-Cheney administration, as well as a former New Jersey governor. We interviewed Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the United Nations, as well as Achim Steiner, the Executive Director of the United Nations Environmental Program. Those are some of the top-level kind of politicians we interviewed. We have, as we spoke earlier, we have a number of the climate change deniers who are funded, either they or their organizations are heavily funded by the industry itself. That includes Myron Ebell from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. We feature Tim Phillips from the Americans for Prosperity organization, which was created by the Koch industry, the Koch brothers, and whose chairman is still David Koch. We feature James Inhofe. That was someone we tried to get an interview with. He's Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma. We tell his story largely through archival footage because he turned down our interview. Unfortunately, he was one of the ones we tried to get and weren't successful, but we do a great job of telling his story. He's kind of the ARC global warming denier in the Senate. He has kind of gone out of his way. Interestingly enough, his number one donor in terms of financial donor of all time is Koch Industries. And above and beyond those, we also have a lot of interesting and very compelling human stories, some from the Gulf of Mexico and the individuals that were really impacted, either through the loss of, like, Keith Jones, who lost his son aboard the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe. We feature Clayton Mathern, who He was out actually about a half mile from the rig when it exploded working on a supply ship, and he went into search and rescue mode immediately and was pulling bodies from the water. And he actually was one of the worst cases that we have seen in terms of the chemical exposure. He's very, very ill. Actually, during our interview, he was rushed to the hospital, and he was diagnosed with paralysis in one of his legs as a result. And then, you know, the communities that we spent time with around the world, Constance Okolot in Uganda, who is a community leader and activist for her people there, and showed us around the impacts that they are facing from climate change. The folks up in Kivalina were wonderful, showing us the erosion on the island up there and what the warming climate has done in terms of basically tearing apart their island and reducing it considerably to the point they have to move. So a lot of interesting stories. You know, we tried to get some of the executives from the big oil companies on camera, and of course they denied us, but we went out of our way to make sure we at least tried. I did get into the Exxon Mobil shareholders meeting, and we took undercover video of that, and I got up and confronted Rex Tillerson, the CEO, about their climate change denial funding. So that was kind of a fun part. But we have a lot of good stories and a lot of great people in the film.
So what now? Are you entering this film in festivals, and when does it come out for the general public?
Yes, we just got finished entering a rough cut to Sundance Film Festival. And right now we're busy working, finishing up our final cut, and that'll probably take us through the rest of the year. And we expect that the film will be ready to be released in the festival circuit as well as ideally worldwide in early 2012.
And I guess a little bit later, would you be selling DVDs online? Because it's never going to come to my local cinema.
Yes, definitely. It'll depend on the distribution deal we get and how soon, you know, the materials are released. But we'll definitely have DVDs available online.
And Craig, you know, the American Petroleum Institute will probably have at least one desk set up just to track you and your film to discredit it. They've got money to burn, and they don't take kindly to criticism. Have you had any pushback?
Not yet, but I'll be honest. We expect it. And, you know, in terms of our opinion, if they come at us trying to discredit anything we say in the film, we made sure that we backed up all of our facts with very legitimate sources. And, you know, I think that all it's going to do is increase the media attention for the film and for our message. So we're happy to talk with them.
Well, in the end, do you leave us in the oil pit with these monsters, or do you have suggestions in the film to motivate change?
The problem with this industry and this issue is that there isn't an easy answer. We can't flick a switch and go off all these dirty sources of energy tomorrow. We can decide as a nation and as a world to wean ourselves off of them, though, as soon as possible, and to really put a priority into investing into clean energies and clean technologies to ensure we have a planet that's livable for our future generations. And we're not doing that now. So that's something we really need to do. And in terms of addressing, you know, a solution within the film, we basically point out what the problem is in terms of who's perpetuating it. And we leave the audience with a website, which is still under development, but it's going to be a very lengthy yet easy to navigate website that really can get people involved, both in their local as well as the national community, to try and make a difference.
But you've got a trailer up now to tease us. Where would we find that?
Yes, we have a trailer on our website at greedylyingbastards.com, and you can kind of read more about the film. There's a synopsis on there. There's some press clippings as well as the trailer.
Our guest is Craig Rosebrough. He wrote and directed, even appears in a new film with the quiet little title, Greedy Lying Bastards. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Craig, thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And thank you, listeners, for coming along with us.